Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. We really don't have a lot left. There's today, and then there's Tuesday after Thanksgiving, and then there are the 3 days where you have presentations. So first of all, I hope you have a nice holiday, so I don't forget to tell you. If you're going to fly, you know, have fun with those full body scans. It's a little bit beyond me why people are so upset about these things. They're actually very cool. I mean, if you look, I mean, you're now completely well versed in all this crap. I mean, so in fact, I should put those scan machines on as one of the topics. At any rate, I owe you an apology. We didn't get exam 2 graded for you yet. Not sure why. I forgot to hassle the TAs, and I guess we're not quite there yet because I didn't see them. I have a question for you. I have to figure out where to go from here. It turns out last time I was looking at what was covered in 141, 142, 143, we had a hole where geometrical optics was actually not being covered. And it's a perfectly good thing to cover right now because it's light, and so we can basically look at how Maxwell's equations leads to the laws of physical optics. So that's part of what we'll start, I mean, laws of geometric optics. It's part of what we'll start today. But then I have a question for you. Have you seen physical optics here at U of R? Right, I mean, those of you, I mean, how many of you have taken 143 and you saw no physical optics? You didn't really see interference, diffraction?
Oh, yeah.
You saw it out there.
We covered physical optics. We just covered it.
Yeah, we saw it.
Things like...
We saw polarization.
Okay, so you've seen some polarization. I'm going to do that anyway today. I guess let me think of what... Did you see Rayleigh's criterion?
The name is familiar.
So you looked at how the width of the diffraction the width of the central diffraction maximum varies with size of slits and wavelength and things like that?
Yes, size of slits.
Okay, I'm not asking if you retained it. I'm just really asking if you've seen it, because, I'm trying to figure out whether or not to cover it. So we'll see. Maybe I'll try to do something different. But that was what happened. I mean, that was my recollection from the last time I taught the class, was that there people had already seen physical optics. So I didn't do anything with that. Okay, so the other thing is, I actually heard from 4 of the groups, and surprise, surprise, 3 of them wanted to be December 9th first, and then December 7th second. One of them actually preferred December 2nd. The third group I heard from got the December 7th, which was their second thing. And the 2 groups I didn't hear from get December 2nd. So that's the way it works. So these are the dates where you'll want to give your presentations. That's all we have going on during those dates. You're supposed to be about 20 minutes, okay, maybe 25 including questions. That still leaves a little time, but you need to make sure that your AV stuff is good. And I mean, it doesn't really work to stand up here and waste 20 minutes trying to get your movie to work or whatever it is. So plan accordingly. I need to send you out the grading sheets. Okay, the way this will work is that you as an individual, for each presentation, you will be responsible to give a grade. And the question that always comes up, do I grade our own presentation? Sure. I don't feel like policing that, and presumably you'll all give your own presentation a pretty good grade, so it just washes out in the end. You know, I mean, I'm okay with that. So So the way it will work is that each of you will evaluate each of the presentations with a number of criteria. Basically, the primary criteria is, did you learn something from it? Did you enjoy it? Did it speak to you? Was it at a reasonable level? Did it include some physics that had something to do with the topic they were talking about? Yes. Okay. These are all the criteria you'll use. You'll give it a score of a 1 to 5, 5 being high, or 1 to 10. I don't remember what I'll put on there, but and then I'll take those scores. I will collate those. Find averages for each group, and I will be a safety valve in case the class is doing something wacko. And there are two examples I've had in the past. One was where a group came up and had a great deal of fun but forgot to do any physics. But they mimicked me really well. It was hysterical. Everybody was rolling in the aisle, so they got a really high grade from everybody in the class. But they actually hadn't talked about the topic they had, and they hadn't done any physics. It wasn't in 142, but it was a freshman thing to do. It was in 121. And sorry, I know some of you are freshmen, but this class is at a different level of maturity than we often see in 121. So that was an example where I vetoed the grade that the class gave, and I knocked them down a good bit. There was an example of one where I was doing a poster session in, I think it was 113. And one group had gone and done an experiment over at the ice rink. They had actually measured the coefficient of friction on the ice using an experiment with ice skaters before and after the Zamboni. They found a consistent factor of 2 difference. It was actually really cool. And it was presented in a fairly boring way where they had tabulated all their data and put it on this poster. And everybody just sort of looked at it and was like, and walked away and gave them a low grade. But if you looked at what they did, I mean, they did describe their experiment. They had this data. They had actually found really cool results. So that was one where the class had graded them very low, and I knocked them up a good bit. So very seldom do I need to do that. I think usually the class is pretty fair. So more or less, I'll be hands-off, and it's up to you to do the evaluation. Once I have, so effectively, you all will determine the ordering of the presentations, and then I will convert that into number grades. And if everybody does a pretty decent job, there'll be some spread, but it won't be huge. And, generally I'll take the group that did really well and stick them up at 100, and the group, any group that does reasonably well below that will still be, high 80s or 90 or something. So there's not a huge spread in this. This isn't a huge curve determiner. It's sort of more of a meant to be fun and a learning experience. So that's how the actual grade goes. Then, so that will be the baseline grade for everybody in that group. It does not matter if the person is here during the presentation unless that is their contribution to the group. Okay, so you don't necessarily have to be here. The group has to do the presentation. That could consist of one person doing the presentation as their part. I mean, I don't know. That's up to you as your group. But what I will also ask each of you to do is to evaluate the members of your group for their contribution. So if somebody has not been coming to any of your meetings, this is how I know about it. The other 6 of you in the group are going to write down the names of everyone in the group, and you're going to evaluate each of those performances on a scale of 1 to 6 or 5 or whatever it is. If you haven't seen anybody for any of your groups, then that's, a 1 or a 0, right? If somebody really drove it and got really excited about it and they clearly went over and above, then you give them like a 5 or a 6. Right? And then, the usual grade might be people came, they sort of did their thing, and they get like a 4, and that's fine. So all I'm really looking at here are the extremes, and I'm looking for consistency. So if somebody gets, if you say that somebody didn't contribute, I will look at other people's assessment of that in the group. I will not touch anybody's grade unless I get a consistent picture within the group. Right, so you can it could be that the person is doing something that you don't know about, and other people in the group do know about. So you may think they didn't do anything. So I sort of have that. If you just decide somebody's a jerk and you want to gig them, you know, you have to get the other members of your group to agree that they're a jerk in order for it to actually work. Okay. If somebody really drove it, you give them a high grade. I'll look for a little consistency with that. But what I'll do with these numbers then, depending on how bad it is and how consistent it is, I might take individual grades and then raise them or lower them relative to that that baseline grade. Okay? So if you have the best group and you do a really good job and I decide to put your baseline at 100, and you really drove it relative to everybody else in your group, and you know, I get a consistent picture of that, you could get a grade higher than 100, right? That could happen. If you don't show up for the group meetings, you can be in the group, but if everybody in the group says you were never there, you will get a zero, right? That's how it's going to work. If it's just that you weren't all that, you know, you sort of did your thing and everybody gives you a little bit, then I'll just drop you a little bit. So I try to avoid having to do the individual juggling, but if I get a consistent picture, I will. If you decide within your group that it's all for one, one for all, and everybody gets a 6, that's fine. You all get the baseline grade. I'm okay with that. If everybody contributed and it was fairly even, I'm completely happy with that. So I will send you example sheets. But that's sort of how it will work. You okay with that? Any questions? How it works? Okay. Okay, so last time we were talking about further characteristics of electromagnetic waves, and just to remind you the picture that we have, we've used boundary conditions where we're very far away, and because of that we basically will see plane waves coming at us, and we have chosen a direction of polarization, at least initially in our looking at electromagnetic waves, and in this case the direction of polarization is along the y-axis, that being the direction of the electric field vector, which defines the direction of polarization. So the solution is harmonic, so we have an amplitude, a harmonic function, periodicity, kx, in the along the direction of propagation, periodicity in time, so we have a frequency, and an arbitrary phase angle. Relative to that, Maxwell then tells us what the solution for B is. It has the same phase. It has an amplitude that's related by a factor of C, which is often written in this way. And it is at right angles to the electric field. So if you say what B or E happens to be, you have specified the B or E for that particular electromagnetic wave. Okay? And this is the solution that you've seen. So as a function of position, it would look like this if we froze time, and if you let time go, these are traveling waves. Because of the minus sign here, they're traveling in the positive x direction. If I put in a positive sign there, they'd be traveling in the negative x direction, just like a wave on a string. So last time we looked at a energy and momentum in electromagnetic waves. And for energy, what we did was we let this wave travel through a narrow box, and we asked how much energy was there. And you can start the calculation by, if you know what E and B are, then instantaneously you can calculate how much energy is in the box. And that this works because the electric field has an energy density and the magnetic field also has an energy density. So I'm not going to rederive all that, but what we found was that the energy flow is quantified by something called the Poynting vector. The direction of the energy flow is given by E cross B. This is always true for that particular wave. And the magnitude of the Poynting vector is the intensity. And intensity is power per square meter, or watts per square meter, time. Okay, so it's how much energy per second hits an area, right? And you would perceive this as brightness for visible light. In sound, it would be sound intensity, for example. So this is a very relevant quantity. Because these things are moving very fast, you often won't... you do sometimes have to worry about instantaneous intensity, but very often what's more important is time-averaged intensity. So if you take the harmonic functions that you have here and you do the time average, this basically goes as E squared or B squared if you wish, and so that goes as a cosine squared or a sine squared depending on which you're using, and the time average of that is a 1/2. So what happens when you do the time average, which could be given by different symbols, is you basically are bringing in a factor of 2 here. And this is not the instantaneous E or B, which remember is oscillating with time, but this is the amplitude squared. So usually if you carry around a rule of thumb, the intensity, the time average intensity, goes as the square of the amplitude of the E, roughly. So that's sort of something to remember. Any questions on this? Electromagnetic waves they carry energy. They also have a momentum. And you can see that a little bit if you can imagine a wave coming through. And if you have an E, you will also have a B. So the E can cause a charge to move up. There's a force on it. And as it moves, it has a velocity. And so V cross B will give a force on the charge this way. So although the electromagnetic field E and B are oscillating very fast, it turns out that you do exert a momentum. And that momentum, as you can already imagine, the velocity will go to some extent as E. The force in the X direction will go something as B. So you're going to have an E times B and S, which is the energy or the power. So there's a relationship between the energy and the momentum. And it turns out to be just the energy divided by C gives you the momentum. That's not something you usually have to deal with. What's usually done, just like with fluids, you don't often deal with forces, but you deal with pressures. So the relevant thing is sort of how much the momentum converts into a force per area on something, because usually that's how the waves interact with things, is more over surface areas. So if the wave is absorbed, we took this and derived the fact that the radiation pressure on a surface goes as S over C. And this is true instantaneously. And if we do the time average, it goes as the time average of S over C. Okay? So there's a basic relationship there. And you have to remember, and this is a very typical thing to see on physics GREs or an exam at some point, is there will be some little word in there that tells you whether it is fully absorbed or reflected. You will not usually see something that is partially, but if they do, they will tell you, 80% reflected or something crazy like that. Generally, they will say a wave is incident on a black surface. When they say black surface, they mean fully absorbed. Or a silvered or mirrored surface, then they mean totally reflected. Or they will tell you fully absorbed or totally reflected. But you will almost always have, you better have something in there, because that determines whether you have a factor of 2 in there. All right, so just watch out for that one. Any questions on all this? Okay, so then last time we started the discussion of polarization, and I find for many students this discussion can be a bit confusing, because I now make a change in what we're looking at. We have been looking at one solution to Maxwell's equations for this plane wave situation we set up, where we said that the polarization was along the y-axis. We've been looking at this picture where the orange would represent the sort of the envelope of the amplitude of the electric field as a function of x, okay? if I wanted to really make a general plane wave solution for something traveling in the x direction, then in fact I have to also add an orthogonal solution to that where the electric field is along, I guess we had it along the y, along the z axis. Okay, so these would form an orthogonal basis out of which we could compose any plane electromagnetic wave propagating in the x direction. Okay, so now what I'm about to spend a lot of time drawing is not an E and a B, but it's going to be these two orthogonal solutions for E for a general plane wave traveling in the x direction. Okay? Each of which has a corresponding B, the direction of which you can figure out by E cross B must go in the x direction. Okay, so there will be also two orthogonal B solutions at right angles to one another, but they are entirely determined by the two orthogonal E solutions. So I don't need to specify those. So you good with that? So although you've now been used to looking at these pictures thinking E and B, now you're thinking E and E. Okay? So let us do the simplest case first, which is where we assume that they have the same amplitude and the same phase. So we're going to have one, the pink one, to be polarized along the y-axis. So this is basically what we've been looking at all along. And then I'm going to add to that the orthogonal solution, also traveling in the x direction, but is polarized along the z-axis. Okay? So that would be in blue. So again, mathematically, this is the solution for the one polarized in the y. This is the solution polarized in the z. These are orthogonal pieces. They are independent of one another in principle. They could have different amplitudes. They could have different phases. So the way I've allowed them to have different amplitudes here, they could have a relative phase difference, so I should have actually a phase angle into one of these. Okay? And now we're about to look at this more general way of looking at things and try to figure out what's going on with the net electric field vector to look at polarization. Any questions on this? All right. It's like being in the presence of a B-grade horror movie or something. What am I doing? Okay. All right, so if we look at this particular situation where I have these each having the same amplitude and the same phase, what I'd like to do is to now picture what's happening with the electric field vector as it's passing through your eyeball. Okay, so I want you to imagine this envelope basically now traveling. And if you can imagine what it looks like to your eyeball when this piece of the wave is passing through your eyeball, you have no electric or magnetic field at that point. Now, a moment later, you have this piece traveling through your eye, and now you've got a field of E, the pink is up this way, a field of the blue E is this way. These are now vector electric fields, so the net electric field will be this way, right, where you just add these two together like components. In time, as this thing travels through, that will go to zero, and then you'll see when this piece of the wave is traveling through your eye, you'll see the net electric field like this. So what your eyeball will see will be an electric field that is growing like this and then coming back and then growing like that, right, at 45 degrees relative to the y and the z. So it is moving along a line, and we call it linear polarization. So let's see, you're going to see it going from the positive z negative, I mean negative, okay, so positive z, positive y. So what I want to look at, this is the y, and then this is z, y cross z gives you x, which is coming right at your eyeball. And so you will be seeing this thing oscillating like so. So it'll sort of be going up and down along this line, and this will be at 45 degrees. And because it's moving in a line, we call this linear polarization. All right, so the next thing I want to do is to look at the same situation. Actually, sorry, I did a change. I was propagating along the x. Yes, that was y and z. Okay, that's fine. So let us assume that E in the x is the same as it was. So we have the x, y, and z. So E in the X will look like this again. And now what I'd like to do is to shift the phase of Y by a factor of pi. So E in the Y is equal to E0, and we're going to assume it has the same amplitude in this case, cosine of KX minus omega T plus pi. So if we take a cosine and shift it by pi, we basically are flipping it in sine. So instead of having this one pointing out this way, it's going to be pointing back the other way at that initial, at x equals 0. So we're going to have, I guess I should try to keep the colors the same. And we use blue. Okay. So we're going to start over here, come back, and now you have your eyeball here again. And what you're going to see as this now passes through your eye, imagine at this moment it's passing through your eye, you have the blue. This, all right, so what I'm going to do, I'm going to take this and rotate it like this. So when we are at this point, the blue is this way, the pink is like that, and as it passes through your eye, this does this and then goes like that, okay? So the net vector is going to look like this, which is going to be in the positive y, negative z, positive z, negative y. So it's going to go like that. You okay with that?
Thank you.
All right, so by change, yeah.
The 45 degrees is only because the amplitudes are the same, right?
Right. Right. See, let me get everything on the same page here. Okay. Now what I'd like to do is to take the same situation. We're going in the X, and this is Y, this is Z. Okay. So now what I want to do is to shift by a factor of pi over 2. So we have the original solution, and now I want to shift the other by a factor of just pi over 2. Yes?
In the last example, the golden factor was drawn with axes that have the z-axis in a different
way. Yeah, sorry.
Wait, no, that was right.
Hold on. So we're propagating in the x. And here's your eyeball, which means you're looking at the Y and the Z, like this. So as it goes into your eyeball, here should be the Z. Is that okay? It is, there. I'm trying to be consistent. There is room for error. Because last time I did this, I used this coordinate system introducing the basic solution that we've been looking at. In my notes, I used that last time. Then, for whatever reason, last time, I switched and had it propagating in the Z. So all my axes in my notes are labeled differently, so I'm having to change that as I go. And so it is possible I'll just write it up incorrectly. So I think I'm okay up to now. All right. So we're again propagating the X. Now, switching this thing into by pi over 2 effectively converts the other one into a sine. If the pink one is a cosine, the other one now becomes a sine. All right. Now, look at what's going on. So we take the Y and the Z axes. And we rotate it like this, so the X is coming out at you. And let us start our eyeball. This isn't drawn all that well. This is actually supposed to be landing right in the middle of this. I should probably shift that a little. Whatever. Okay, so we have the Y and the Z. I want you to imagine that this part of the wave where you have the pink with amplitude zero, not amplitude, but the current magnitude of zero, and the blue electric wave is full amplitude out this way. So at that point, the pink is zero, you have the electric field vector like this, okay? Now, as this propagates through your eyeball, the pink begins to grow and the blue goes to zero. So it does, as this is the blue, it goes like this as the pink one grows. So if you look at the magnitude, as you add these two things together, initially you're going to have everything this way, and then the pink begins to grow as this one gets shorter, so the net vector will become something up at an angle here, but mostly along the Z, okay? And then as the wave goes through your eyeball even more, this one becomes a little shorter, the pink one becomes a little bit bigger, and the electric field vector basically rotates up like this until the pink, the blue is zero and the pink is non-zero. And so the whole electric field vector, the net electric field vector, rotates like this as it goes into your eyeball. All right? And we call that circular polarization for obvious reasons that this thing is going in a circle. And it is rotating in a particular direction. It is going clockwise. So that's known as right circular polarization. Not X. Sorry, as it's going into your eyeball, it's going like this. So that you're perceiving it as rotating clockwise.
The first thing that hits your eyeball is the furthest to the right.
That's confusing.
So you'll see. E, and then this vector itself will rotate around in time like so. And this is clockwise. So we call this right circular polarization. Oddly enough, this gives you a negative helicity if you use helicity language. If you use the right-hand rule for the spin of a particle or whatever, you have a helicity definition that actually works backwards from this. So be careful that there's a little bit of a strangeness with that. Okay, this is hard to visualize. I mean, I hope that you would ask questions if you're having trouble. But I did have created, to my very own specifications, the ultimate Java applet for this. All right, but now I have to find it. Okay. So this would be the initial situation that we had, where if I freeze it about now, okay, that's basically the first drawing we had. And so we have E and E. Y and Z, propagating X, and E are both at full amplitude, and when you add these together vectorially, you get the net electric field, which is this blue, the purple thing, okay? Then as the wave propagates, if you imagine what the net electric field is in this plane, you will see that net vector change as the E and B, the E and the E that are in this plane actually change. And so as that happens, you see this net electric field vector oscillating here at 45 degrees. This view being what is coming into your eyeball. So this is the thing that you want to mentally create to figure out what the polarization is. You good with that?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, now what I want to do is to shift the phase of one of these by a factor of pi. Which is, what, 90 degrees? Oops, what am I doing? Oh, that's pi over 2. Sorry, I want to do the full pi. Okay, so now one of them has been shifted in amplitude relative to the other. And now you can see linear polarization again. But in this case, we're oscillating in these other two quadrants. So we've just simply rotated it. All right. Now, an interesting thing is you can take crystals that have indices of refraction, which is sort of the speed with which light propagates, that vary in this dimension versus that dimension, and you can cause this rotation depending on the thickness of the crystal. So you can send light through and take the plane of polarization and rotate it like that. Okay? All right. Now, I can change the angle of this. As was pointed out earlier, if I change the amplitude of one of these waves, which you can do because this, these are both general, I mean, the, it's, these are independent solutions. So it's the, if let's say I just change the amplitude of one of these, and make the other a little smaller. So it's more. And now you can see I've actually rotated this line a little bit. Okay? But it's still linear polarization. It just has a different angle defining its line of oscillation. All right. Okay, so now the amplitudes are the same. Now what I'd like to do is take the relative angle between the two and shift it instead of by a factor of full pi, but by pi over 2, which is 90 degrees. Somehow the amplitudes... Oh, yeah, okay, it depends on where I am. All right, so now I've shifted them by pi over 2. And now you look at the net electric field vector. You see it rotating, in this case, clockwise. And to help you visualize this, you can turn on the trace path toggle down here. Which traces the head of the electric field vector as it goes around. Because the amplitudes of the two waves are the same, this will trace out a circle as it goes around. So this would be specifically right-handed circular polarization because it's going clockwise. It rotates clockwise as it heads into your eyeball. Okay? Now, I'm going to take this phase angle, and instead of making this relative difference of one to the other of 90 degrees, I'm going to shift it to minus 90 degrees. So instead of taking one and shifting it this way, I'm going to shift it back the other way by pi over 2. Or not. Come on. Okay. amplitudes are the same. But now, with the phase shifted the other way, you'll see that it is rotating counterclockwise, and this would be left-handed circular polarization instead of the right-handed circular polarization as it comes into your eye. You okay with this? All right. Now I can change the amplitude of one of these. Now it's basically the same thing, except the amplitude of one of the solutions is bigger than the other, and now you get an ellipse. So this would be left-handed elliptical polarization, of which circular polarization is just a special case. If you get a different phase, then you can get pretty much whatever you want. And this is the power of the two orthogonal solutions. You can dial up any angle for linear polarization, any ellipticity, any angle at which the ellipse is skewed. It's okay. This is really cool.
Awesome.
Is this not the neatest Java applet you have ever seen? I was beside myself for a week when I first saw this. After I
set it to 45 degrees, I'm just curious.
Which to 45?
Phase.
Positive 45. Good night. There's a little lag in this. Okay. Okay. Polarization. So this is on the web, and you can play with it all you want to make sense of this stuff. Pull it out at parties. Show it to grandma over Thanksgiving. All right. So if you recall, last time we took these two different layers of Polaroid material. Remember, the Polaroid material allows only one orientation of polarization to come through. And we saw that if we have them with the same orientation as the light comes through, the light is cut by intensity by one of them, not so much by the second and as it comes through. But as you rotate one relative to the other, the intensity of the light drops. And as it is in the orthogonal direction, then you have no intensity coming through. Do you have a question? Okay. Then you can insert a third piece inside this at some angle, and you'll actually get a little light through. So we need to actually look at this quantitatively a little bit. And so let's imagine that we have the light headed into our eyeball, and we have Y and Z here. And let us just think about the initial electric field vector to be, say, along this direction. And I'm going to call it E0 in this case, where E0 is not so much the amplitude, but just the initial, let's just say it's the electric field vector for fixed time initially in terms of our thinking. And then let us suppose that we have a material that has a polarization axis. Oriented up and down along the y. So, if that's the case, what it means is that any electric field that is not oriented along the y will be absorbed, basically, and only that which is along the y will come through. So if we define the angle with respect to the polarization axis for the current polarization of that wave to be theta, then the electric field component that comes through goes as E cosine theta. Okay? So that as the light passes through this polaroid material, the new intensity goes as E0 squared times the cosine square theta, which, remember that intensity goes as the electric field magnitude squared. So the new intensity will go as the old intensity, or the initial intensity, before it passes through the material, times the square of the cosine of that angle between the polarization of the wave and the polarization angle for the material. Did that make any sense? All right. So let's look at a situation where we have unpolarized light incident on something with a polarization angle. So let us suppose that I have a plane polarizer, which I represent by these lines, and you can imagine that it basically will allow only light with this orientation through. That's the idea. And let us say that we have initially unpolarized light, which means it has random orientations. So it's unpolarized plane wave. So although it's really, I can't draw it this way, the idea is that I have a plane polarizer that's only allowing one orientation through, but the light itself that's coming through, these arrows, I represent the electric field oscillating, which is in all different directions, perpendicular to this axis of propagation. So it's like this as a function of time in some random sort of way. And this is typically what you'll get for light from a source like an incandescent lamp or whatever, where basically it's coming from many, many different atomic processes, and you can have random orientations for the electric field vector as it comes at you. Yes?
So in the example where you shifted the y-axis by pi over 2 and z-axis, you got that clockwise motion. So wouldn't that, based on where that is, it would pass through the polarizer unchanged?
Right, so what will happen is instantaneously, as the circular polarized light is passing through a plane polarizer, you will have maybe no light passing through, and then you will have the full amplitude passing through as the electric field vector net oscillates through the correct direction. But if you look at it as a function of time, you end up with an electric field vector that is oscillating in the direction of the that's allowed by the plane polarizer. So you can take circularly polarized light, pass it through a plane polarizer, and you are converting it into plane polarized light. So that's a way of doing it. As a function of time, it's still going to be doing, it'll have to be doing this, I think, when it goes through the plane polarizer. Okay, but in this case, it's not circular polarization, it's random polarization. All directions coming through, hits a plane polarizer, and now you are only allowing that component of the electric field vector which is up and down. Yeah.
What happens to the other components that don't get through?
They get absorbed or reflected or whatever. Yeah. I don't know whether absorbed or reflected would be the right. I mean, I suppose you could have polarizers that do either. So now what happens is you will get all of that electric field component that is oriented in this direction, okay, which is going to be half of it. So it's almost like a time average as this thing passes through. The intensity will be cut by a factor of 2. You're basically removing half the energy as it comes through. So the light that comes through will be plane polarized. And the intensity will equal 1/2 of the initial intensity. Okay with that? So this is why when I had the bulb and I put one layer of Polaroid over it, it got dimmer by a factor of 2. Slightly over a factor of 2 probably, because depending on the thickness, you'll also absorb a little bit of the light. However, if I take the second layer of Polaroid and I put it over with the same orientation, the intensity didn't drop very much. It only dropped a little bit because the second layer of plastic absorbed a tiny bit of light. But it didn't really absorb much. So the intensity didn't drop by another factor of 2. All right, so a standard problem that you'll get is that you send initially unpolarized light through a linear polarizer two linear polarizers at angle theta with respect to one another. So we have our axis. We have the initially unpolarized light with intensity of 0. Let's say we go through one linear polarizer, which is up and down, and then we'll go through a second linear polarizer, which is relative to the up and down angle. We'll say that this is at an angle theta with respect to the first. So what we've already seen is that as we pass the unpolarized light through the first polarizer, we get an initial I1 here, where I1 is equal to 1/2 the initial intensity. And now the electric field component, which it's all up and down, so you can you don't really have to worry about the time averaging of the electric field component of all this light gets cut by a factor of cosine theta. The intensity goes as the square of that, so the intensity that you get over here is less than what you have here by a factor of cosine squared. So now over here you'll have the light which is polarized along the plane that's allowed by the second polarizer, but the intensity I2 is equal to I1 times cosine squared of theta, because you've dropped the electric field component by a factor of cosine theta and intensity goes as the square of that. So the intensity that we have in the end over here is equal to 1/2 times I0 times the cosine square of theta. If theta is 90 degrees, cosine is 0, which is why if you take the two Polaroid films and you put them at 90 degrees to one another, you get nothing through. And if they are along with each other, you get the full intensity through. Okay? Now, we did the example where we had the same sort of thing, but we put a third sheet. So we had a polarizer like this, and then a polarizer where theta is equal to 90 degrees. And now you allow through this one only light polarized this way, and through this one only light polarized at right angles to that, and there is no component of this which is at right angles to itself, so nothing comes through. Okay? But then we put a third polarizer in between the two at an angle. So this is at some angle theta, which is less than 90 degrees. And now what happens is through the first one you get the light oriented a certain way. Through the second one, now because the angle isn't 90 degrees, there is a component of this which is at that angle. So you'll actually get a little bit of light like so, and now there is a component of this one which is at the 90 degrees, so you'll end up with a little bit coming through. So if we look at it edge on, or coming at us, the first one, you have unpolarized light. Actually, let's do this a different way. So when you're at this point, you have the unpolarized light coming straight at you. So it looks like that. Now we're at the second stage, where our eyeball is right here. And what comes through is the light that is oriented like this. Then we go to the third stage. And if we take the polarizer in the third stage is at some angle like this, and there is a component of this electric field vector which can be projected onto this axis. And so that's the piece that comes through. The intensity is dropped by the square of the cosine of the angle between them. And then now you have a component of this vector which projects down to the orthogonal vector, so you get some light coming through. Whereas if I remove this middle piece, then I have light that comes through like this, and then it goes through the second one, which is polarized like this one, and there's no component that can come through, so nothing gets through. You okay with that? Sort of a standard sort of polarization problem you'll see. So all right, so what I wanted to do was to spend some time doing what we call geometrical optics, or looking at the laws of optics that and think about, at least plausibly, how they come from what we know about electromagnetic waves. So in a vacuum, light travels with a velocity c, which we found was 1 over the square root of epsilon naught mu naught. And we have looked at electric and magnetic waves in, or electric and magnetic fields in materials. Light is made up of electric and magnetic fields. So just like the electric and magnetic fields will vary depending on whether you have them embedded in a material or not, you might expect the light, the electric and magnetic fields in the light, to also vary if you put the light in a material. So if we consider light in a material, the relevant thing is epsilon and mu as opposed to epsilon naught and mu naught. And this will be, I mean, if you take the Maxwell's equations and put them in a material and solve for the waves, you will find waves propagating with not 1 over the square root of epsilon naught mu naught, but 1 over the square root of epsilon mu, which turns out to be a number that is less than c. So you will have a velocity v which is less than c as you go from a vacuum to a material. And different materials will have different epsilons and mu's, as you know. So we quantify this effect by defining what is known as the index of refraction. And the index of refraction is greater than 1, and it is equal to c over v for the material. Okay. So the bigger the index of refraction is, the slower the light moves in that material. A typical index of refraction for glass is sort of like 1.5. For water, it's about 1.3. So light goes a third slower in water than it does in regular vacuum. Diamond has a really high index of refraction. I forget what it is, but it's like 2 or something on that, or 2.3. All right, so in the vacuum, we have defined the frequency. The frequency is specific for the color of the light, right? And We've said that the wavelength times the frequency equals the speed. And I'm going to call this lambda zero because this is in a vacuum. When we go into a material, lambda times nu is equal to v. So lambda times nu is equal to, what is v is going to be c over n. So lambda in the material times n is equal to c over nu, which is equal to lambda zero. So the wavelength in the material changes. Okay? And that will allow us to sort of look at the plausibility of some strange things happening. All right. My watch says I have a few minutes, but both computers are telling me I don't, so I guess I don't. So we'll come back to this. This is Tuesday before Thanksgiving, right? Okay, so have a good break. I have posted a problem set that's sort of a longish one, which is due the Thursday after you return. There will be one more after that. Today's Tuesday. Yes, there's workshops today. There's no workshop Wednesday. If you can, go to one of the earlier workshops, which is one today. But the workshop that's normally scheduled Wednesday is after classes are nominally over and most of you will be gone. So.